This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with economist Rick Wolf about what's happening in Washington on the budget talks.
Rick points out that the debate we're seeing between Republicans and Democrats is a real sideshow. It's not really going to affect the deficit. It's certainly not going to help people get jobs, and it's not going to help the U.S. economy.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, Tim DeChristopher, the environmental activist who disrupted that oil and gas auction in Utah, was just sentenced to prison. They threw the book at him. What's your thinking on it?
Well, known as Bitter Number 70, I think that he received a highly disproportionate sentence. That would be 2 years in prison and $10,000 in restitution that he has to pay.
People get less than that for manslaughter.
Exactly. And really, as I understand it, he entered into the auction, as it were, to cause a disruption, to get his message out there. But by the time the auction ended, he'd, I guess, driven the prices up on some of the parcels of land and, in fact, had made winning bids on 14 pieces of land, some of it near national parks. He knew he didn't have the money to pay for it, but I've heard that friends, well-known people, raised the money and were going to pay for it, and yet he still got this harsh sentence.
Well, they made an example out of him. They want to be able to sell the oil and natural gas rights underneath a good part of that beautiful state, and Tim DeChristopher was against it, and look what happened to him.
He did gain a following on campuses around the country and among activists, and he founded a civil disobedience group called Peaceful Uprising. And Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary said that Tim is a hero to him. And indeed, Tim is a hero to us here.
Absolutely.
Michael and Michael, a couple of weeks ago, 14 individuals were arrested by the FBI on charges related to so-called cyber terrorism.
Well, the group has been going by the, quote, handle of Anonymous. And I don't know if listeners know about Anonymous, but if you go online and look at some of the YouTubes, they're completely fabulous. I don't know what their exact politics are, but they certainly understand what the politics of the imperial world in the United States are, and they want to destroy those bad politics in the sense of ending torture, ending imperialism. And they put on those masks. What are the masks from the movie?
V for Vendetta.
They put on the masks of the guy with the mustache and the white, and there's groups of them out there. They, as far as I know, have no relationship to each other. It's done completely independently. And I think they were accused of attacks on PayPal, is that right?
That's PayPal. They're charged actually with several counts of conspiracy and intentional damage to a protected computer, and allegedly coordinated and executed distributed denial of service, DDoS attacks against PayPal's computer servers.
Well, the PayPal attacks were because PayPal was the conduit for giving money to WikiLeaks.
It's called
the... And the indictment says Anonymous referred to those attacks on PayPal as, quote, Operation Avenge Assange.
Right. It's called denial of service when you flood a website. And what's interesting about PayPal is the conduit through which you use MasterCharge and Visa. And there's now a lawsuit in Europe against MasterCharge and Visa by various servers who were helping, who were portals for WikiLeaks. And what they say, it's an antitrust lawsuit. It's an antitrust filing with the authorities in Europe, because MasterCharge and Visa control 95% of all payments on the internet. So they're claiming an antitrust violation, because if you cut off MasterCharge and Visa, and they point, you basically cut off the lifeline of any organization in the world who uses them, and the threat that you can, we don't have to tell our listeners, the threat to political organizations out there by these businesses with not even an indictment yet of WikiLeaks or anything like that, and MasterCharge and Visa just cut them off.
Well, and you're right, Michael, that this is international, because in a press release issued by the Department of Justice, it says that the operational activities, meaning the arrest, and they also gave subpoenas to a number of other activists. They were done in coordination with the Metropolitan Police Service in the United Kingdom and the Dutch National Police Agency. And it says the FBI thanks the multiple international, federal, and domestic law enforcement agencies who continue to support these operations.
Right. These are going on all over the world. And last week was a particularly interesting week on this because of the 14 arrests you mentioned. And there was also the indictment and arrest of a 24-year-old named Aaron Swartz. Most of you probably haven't heard of Aaron Swartz. Aaron Swartz is 24 years old. He's a fellow at Harvard. And at 14 years old, what did he do? He discovered part of the code, or invented part of the code, for the RSS feed, which is how a lot of people who are listening to this get their programming from WBAI from around the world. So at 14 years old, Aaron Swartz does this. He believes in basically free speech. And what he did, according to the indictment, he downloaded from a site called Gestor, J-S-T-O-R, which means journal storage. Journal storage is where all the academic articles almost in the world are put up. It has 32,000 scientific and legal, et cetera, magazines. According to the indictment, some 4.5 million separate documents were downloaded from the Gestor site. They weren't distributed, but they were downloaded from the site. And the belief, whether it's of Aaron or others, and I don't want to quote what he thinks, I just know from what I read, is that it's free access to information. And he looks at these attempts, whether anonymous or the assault on Aaron Swartz, the indictment, is really a way to cut down free speech on the internet. And that's right. If you would allow, if this was in the public square and you had cops just busting everybody, that would be a violation of the First Amendment. This is too.
And just to let listeners know the severity of this, the charge of intentional damage to a protected computer has a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine. Each count of conspiracy carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and, again, $250,000 fine.
So what we're seeing out here in the first update about Tim DeChristopher, and the second one on Anonymous and Aaron Swartz, and in the third one I want to talk to you about is the incredible repression of the government, as now we're seeing an attempt by grassroots people and other people to go up against really government secrecy, government control of information, and the government itself. Michael?
I was going to say that when the government uses the conspiracy charge, it's the darling of the prosecutorial office, conspiracy.
Yeah, who said that, Michael? Learned Hand.
Learned Hand said
Learned
that?
Learned Hand said that.
Well, for our listeners, yeah. Learned Hand was a chief judge for a while on the Second Circuit here in New York, one of the most learned judges, Learned Hand. But they also hand melons, which are a type of melon that you get in upstate New York from his family farm. Anyway, that's about Learned Hand. But let's keep going.
So okay. Learned Hand had the best name for a judge, second only to Judge Minor Wisdom.
Might have been August Hand, but anyway, I don't remember the other one. So we have two.
It was August Hand invented the hand melon.
Right. So
we're
have
getting
two.
Sidetracked here. I just wanted to say the darling of the prosecutors in terms of a charge is conspiracy. And the reason is that they don't have to prove that a crime was committed.
Right, they can just prove people were thinking about a crime, essentially, in one overt act. And it's like, imagine, really one way to imagine it is spokes on a wheel. And there's somebody in the center of the wheel who, well, they're thinking about committing a crime or something, what the government calls a crime, and they do something like, you know, send a mail or something. And then the government's claim is even though the people at the outer spokes of the wheel don't know the person in the middle, don't do anything, that they somehow are involved in the conspiracy because they're doing something similar. And the word, of course, conspiracy comes from conspire, which means to breathe together. So that's where the crime comes from.
And it works with juries. If the juries are scared, they'll get a conviction on that charge.
I'm sure most of our listeners remember David Hicks. David Hicks is the man who was first arrested and taken to Guantanamo. He was the first client of mine in the Center for Constitutional Rights. Eventually, he was freed after some kind of a plea deal and sent back to Australia. But he was the actual first person who the Center for Constitutional Rights represented in 2002. I remember making the call to his attorney in Australia when I said, we want to represent your client on a habeas. David is living peacefully in Australia. David Hicks wrote a book called Guantanamo, My Journey. The book was published last year by Random House and has reportedly sold 30,000 copies. And no U.S. publisher has gotten the book rights yet, but the Australian government, in an interesting move, is now trying to seize all the assets or all the money that David Hicks has gotten for writing this book. Here's this poor guy who wrote a book, put unjustly in Guantanamo, tortured to heck, served 8 years in Guantanamo, not served, imprisoned illegally for 8 years, forced into a plea deal on what's called an Alford plea, which you don't have to go into the technicalities, but it's without really admitting guilt, forced into a plea deal on a BS crime that didn't even exist at the time he allegedly was involved in any way at all. And he goes back to Australia. They send him back. And now the Australian government, under similar to what New York has, a Son of Sam law. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Whatever
yes.
it is, where you seize the assets of people who've committed crimes.
Well, you don't let them profit.
You don't let them profit. That's it. It's not that you seize the assets. You don't let them profit. The irony of it all, of course, is he never really committed a crime, that what he pleaded guilty to wasn't a crime at the time it was allegedly committed. It was done to get him out of Guantanamo in a military commission, which is an illegal commission. And as is pointed out in the news articles about David Hicks, is the prime minister of the time of Australia, I guess it's Howard, actually, at that very moment that David was in Guantanamo, not only helped in his interrogation, I mean, through Australian agents, and helped in the torture and all that, he was committing the worst crime in the world, Howard. He was joining the war in Iraq with the United States, one of the key countries that went into Iraq in the aggressive war with Bush. And, of course, Howard is profiting like crazy from his stuff. But here's poor old David Hicks. His book, Guantanamo, My Journey, and the few dollars he's making from that are being taken away. Well, there's a big stink about it in Australia. It's apparently a good book, but it's hard to get here because it hasn't been published. We are pleased to welcome returning guest Rick Wolf, a professor of economics. He also has an amazingly good show on WBAI, Economic Update. Earlier this year, Rick pointed out how the Democratic and Republican debate over spending cuts, while consequential for those who need the safety net in the United States, are really inconsequential in terms of cutting the budget deficit. He says the debate is essentially a sideshow and inconsequential when the federal budget's projected deficit of $1.5 trillion will carry a huge interest cost that will decimate the public safety net. Now, as both parties are committed to a broken and corrupt system, Rick points out that historically, transitioning to another economic system, or really dealing with the problems of a broken U.S. economy and a tax system that taxes only the poor and not the rich, does not work. And basically, transitioning to another economic system is not in the public discussion. Rick says that the tools used to recover from the 1930s economic collapse can't be used today, mainly because in the last 75 years, there's been a rising national debt, a huge budget deficit, and lower taxes on the wealthy, as well as an economy that's in collapse. Rick joins us today in the studio to talk more about the fake debate between the Republicans and the Democrats, all on the backs of the poor and the working class.
Rick Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Rick, the government is allegedly supposed to be shutting down. We're pre-recording this interview, but come Monday, August 2nd, the government's supposed to be shutting down, bankrupt, can't pay its bills. What's your take on that? Is this for real?
No, this is mostly theater. That is, most of the people I talk to around the world who are in the business of finance or government are quite clear that the United States will work this out. It is a sign of the dysfunction of our political system that they can't do it in a reasonable way, the way they have done it countless times over the last 30 years. It is a normal procedure of government to periodically ask for the debt ceiling to be raised so that they can borrow the amount of money stipulated by the budgets they've passed. This is no different. The budget we're in now, fiscal 2011, was passed last year by Republicans and Democrats and signed by the president. They knew then what the national debt was. They knew then that the budget they passed would require borrowing $1.5 trillion and that that would take them over the debt ceiling. So there's nothing new, nothing unexpected, nothing surprising, nothing. This is well understood and was well understood many, 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 many months ago. Normally, whoever the sitting president is asks for the debt ceiling to be raised. Bush did it, I think, eight times. It's normal. And usually the opposition party says, gee, you should have managed things better, and then votes for it because what's the option? The only different thing this time is that the normal procedure has been unhinged because it's politically advantageous for the Republicans, and I also believe for the Democrats, to make theater around this event, try to position themselves effectively for the election next year.
Well, what it's allowing the Democrats to do is to actually impose part of an austerity budget. That's what I see happening here. And so that's why I think your point that they may have a hand in this, maybe that's the reason. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they're presiding, because Obama has already accepted this, on a fairly massive cut in a whole host of social programs, including Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that they've agreed to. The only thing they have left then to not go to their own constituents looking kind of defeated is to make a big deal out of the fact that the cuts they're willing to accept are smaller than the draconian version the Republicans want, so that they can position themselves as the defenders of the widows and the orphans and the old people and the sick people in the standard Democratic way. So they can give away the actual game by agreeing to massive cuts, yet be not so evil as the alternative, and that must be their political strategy.
But you think this is going to be solved. You began. I want to go back to your other point here, but you think this is going to be solved by either August 2nd or sometime shortly thereafter?
Right.
And you don't think the effect will be that great?
I don't think anyone knows what the effects are. This is a little bit winging it. The Republicans don't know. The Democrats don't know. They fundamentally don't care because they have long ago decided that their political needs and strategies are unhooked from the underlying economic situation, that that has a momentum of its own. It'll take care of itself. Their job is, given the economic system as it works, to get themselves elected to make it work better. Each of them thinks they can make it work better. And I think so what you're going to see is an agreement. Maybe a few numbers here will help people understand. We're spending $3.5 trillion this year as a federal government. We're raising $2 trillion. That means $1.5 trillion of the total outlay of the government has to be borrowed, otherwise it's not going to happen. And that's money that will be used to pay for old people's needs, to fight wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Pakistan, to help cities and states that need federal support, and so on. And if the government, in fact, doesn't raise the debt limit, it is saying, that is, the Congress is saying to the president, we're not going to allow you to raise a portion of the money you would have had to raise by borrowing. What the government then does, and a lot of people seem confused about this, is open to the government. They are not going to have as much money to spend. What they choose not to spend on is completely open. So, for example, it is highly likely that they will continue to pay interest on the national debt, since it's a relatively small part of the total budget, and it would be very peculiar and self-destructive not to do that. So the actual creditors in the immediate situation have nothing to fear. They're likely to cut back elsewhere. Where elsewhere is will be fought out inside the government of Mr. Obama. He will have the discretion to cut back, if he has to, for a week, for a month, however long this theater goes on. And we shouldn't assume that the United States government will default, extremely unlikely and not necessary in this situation. We should just be aware that for the rest of the world, and I read a lot of papers in Europe and elsewhere to get it, to be clear about this, for the rest of the world, you have now a double whammy that is what we really should be thinking about. We have an American economy, the richest and biggest powerful driver of the world economy, having basically collapsed in 2007 and 2008 and having been unable to recover since. That's the reality. It's an economic capitalist leader that isn't functioning very well. And however happy Americans are to be distracted by Europe's difficulties and difficulties elsewhere, the bottom line is this economy isn't working well and is not solving its crisis. This is now a deeper, longer crisis than any since the Great Depression and shows no end in sight. And this crisis in Washington about the debt ceiling means that we're now saying to the world, on top of a dysfunctional economic system, we have a dysfunctional political system that cannot function in the normal way. That's the lesson. It's not that we're going to default, and it's not that they aren't going to reach an agreement in the end. Those are highly unlikely outcomes. What is clear is that something scary for the world has to be come to terms with. The leading economy cannot function, and the leading political stability symbol isn't. It isn't very stable, and it isn't successful, and it isn't solving its problems, and it looks like it's veering off the rails in what it is willing to do and what it is willing to threaten. That means every other player in the world, from a Chinese official to a Spanish bank to an investor in Brazil, has to rethink a little bit what he or she thought. Is it safe to park your money in the United States? It's not unsafe. We're not going to have a fleeing of capital. That's silly. That's not going to happen. But 1,000 small decisions are going to be made a little differently from now on. And the longer this lasts, by the way, that damage has already been done. Even if they make an agreement before this program airs, that damage has already been done. It can get worse the longer this lasts, the crazier it gets. You should also be aware that for most people, for example, in New York City, where I live and that I encounter on Wall Street, who are hedge fund operators and things like that, they think the folks in the Tea Party and the Republican Party are crazy. They are not supportive of this activity. They want an orderly government that works in the usual way that they have become accustomed to for half a century. This is not what they want. They much prefer Mr. Obama, with all the things about him they don't like. Number one being his verbal attack on Wall Street and so on. They're very angry about that. They gave him a lot of money. They don't like that. But compared to the Tea Party, who are prepared apparently to do all kinds of loony things, they are not supportive. And whatever your political perspective and your calculations, to imagine that this behavior of the Republicans is getting massive support in Wall Street, that's simply a mistake. It may be getting support in small businesses around the United States who feel that the government is an enemy and who want their taxes not to go up at all costs. That's clearly who they're pitching to. But that does not include the largest businesses, the multinational businesses. This is another sign that the United States is not the stable, reliable leader of the capitalist world economy. It's an economy in trouble. And that trouble is showing up politically as well as economically, which only worries people more.
As between the two major classes, not the small business owners in the middle, but the large capitalists and bankers on the top and the rest of people on the bottom. I mean, shouldn't the bankers and the big business pay more taxes instead of the people on the bottom having to give up health care and education and their Social Security? Isn't it that struggle also?
Yeah, in my judgment, that's the struggle. But that's not a struggle that is recognized by either political party. There's absolutely no significant portion of either the Democrats or the Republicans that is even thinking like that. We have to face that. The audience that's listening to this program has to understand. There is no serious proposal working its way through the Congress to provide employment for the tens of millions of people that have no work. That's a stunning statement. The president continues to go on television and say that he has a program that provides incentives and stimulus for the private sector to employ our unemployed. He's been saying that for 2.5 years. The unemployment rate hasn't budged. That's a failed policy. In any society that had a genuine opposition, they would be screaming bloody murder about the failed policy. But we pretend in the United States, both parties, that the president's statement is a wonderful bipartisan commitment to the private sector. It is a bipartisan commitment to ignore the problem of unemployment and to focus the entire conversation on the government's ability to keep borrowing money without even raising the question, why are we borrowing money in the first place? People should understand the range of dispute between Republicans and Democrats in Washington now is over, they say, the deficit. But when they actually talk about it, here's what they're saying. The most extreme proposal is to cut $4 trillion over the next 10 years. By the way, has no chance of passing, but it's the most extreme one put forward. Less extreme have been put forward by Mr. Boehner for the Republicans, by Mr. Obama and Mr. Reid in the Senate for the Democrats, and by that peculiar group of six senators that intervened over the last couple of weeks. They are all talking about deals in the range of $2 to $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years. Now let's do the simple arithmetic. Let's assume, just for sake of hypothetical, $3 trillion gets agreed to. It won't be, but let's say it. That works out over 10 years to $300 billion a year. This year alone, the deficit the United States will run is $1,500 billion, $1.5 trillion. So if you get a big agreement to cut $300 billion, you're still left with a deficit of $1.2 trillion added to the national debt. By historical standards, this is a stunning increase in indebtedness. So look at the theater. Two parties claiming they're deeply moved by the problem of a deficit, working out an agreement whose one clear, solid outcome will be a massive increase in the deficit this year and for years into the future. That's why this is a surrealistic moment and is recognized by all aware folks around the world. As such, it's a sign of an economic system in trouble and a political system that's living in la-la land, where the political goal of winning the next election has simply pushed all the real economic difficulties facing the country off the table.
But let me ask about that, because you've talked on our show a lot about austerity. As you mentioned, what we see happening as they attempt to better their borrowing ability, or et cetera, whether it's in Europe or here, is austerity. Yeah. And one question, after Clinton left office, you know, there were budget pluses going on. And then Bush takes office and there's all this, you know, cutbacks on taxes. And then there's huge, huge deficits. And one question is, are these deficits in part being created to really eliminate the social safety net? Is that what's going on in part? I mean, maybe that's too conspiratorial. Maybe it's some other factor. But it
I wouldn't make it the major part of the story, but it's certainly part of the story. There's certainly part of the support for what's going on is an age-old agenda, as old as the New Deal at least, which sees the government's role in the economy as way too much, way too excessive, and wants to get rid of that, wants to replace all of that with the private sector for ideological reasons, because they can make some money, a bunch of businesses see an opportunity there. So yes, that's a support as it has always been there. But the interesting question is, why is it able to become powerful now? It's been there all along, trying to move both Republican and Democratic parties, and seems much more successful now. And I think the reason is a set of other circumstances have come in to kind of give them an opportunity to kind of carry the day. I wouldn't sell short the reality of the credit. There is a tendency in the United States, usually associated with Keynesian economics, to believe that every capitalist collapse or crisis of the sort we're in can and should be easily dealt with by having the government simply move in massively, borrow the money that's necessary, run a deficit, get our economy going again, and then pay off the deficit later. This is the smart thing. People like Paul Krugman keep writing that you must be a moron if you don't understand this is the way the economy works, and certainly is the way Keynesians teach it. This is a very mistaken way of thinking. It imagines that building up the debt of a government has no cost to it, has no consequence to it. But that's really silly. When Keynes wrote in the 1930s, governments didn't have anything like the debts they have now. For a government to borrow now is to borrow in a world in which they're saying to the potential creditor, please lend me huge amounts of money, even though I already owe a lot of money. The creditors, who are after all the same big businesses and rich people that we talk about in every other context, they're not stupid. They look at governments from Greece to the United States, and they say these governments are now so indebted that they have to take a growing portion of their money that they raise from their people in taxes, not use it to service those people, not use it to do any of the things that their people want, but instead to ship it as a debt service to their creditors. The creditors know that at a certain point, there's going to be trouble. You cannot continue to cut the masses' standard of living to make money for big bankers. That's not a politically sustainable program. Not here, not in Greece, not anywhere else.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
just joining us, we're talking with Rick Wolf, professor of economics. Let me ask you about the trouble, because I think that gets us into a certain period of activism. I just look around and I see Madison and 100,000 people in Madison. I see them in Milwaukee. I see the G20 recently in Canada, where there were huge demonstrations. Right. We go all the way back to Seattle to the WTO in 1999. We go to Europe and we see hundreds of thousands, in fact, maybe millions of people hitting the streets, really not about necessarily war or democracy, but around what I think you're pushing toward the fact that they don't have enough money to buy food, austerity, et cetera. And if you were looking at the world right now, and I think it's in flux right now, none of us can tell how this is going to come out. But I would say we're in the beginning of a major shift going on about people hitting the streets and people trying to make social change. And that's my optimism in a way. But I just want your thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, I just came back a few weeks ago from Europe, and I asked that question a lot. First of all, it's really important for Americans to know, and the silence of the press here is stunning. There have been multiple general strikes across Europe. Here's a little historical reminder. We have not had a 24-month period in European history since the Great Depression in which we've had this many countries with this many general strikes. So by the level of strike activity alone, both industrial strikes but also general strikes, which are much harder to organize. And I won't even mention last September 29th when you had a European-wide coordinated general strike that dozens of countries participated in. You already have in Europe the most powerful mobilization. Now, is it a success yet? I don't think so. It is subject to all the divisions on the left, which are serious. It is subject to a disbelief that all of this is happening. They thought they were on the cusp with the unification of Europe, of basically replacing the United States as the world's center of wealth and power, which in many ways there was a reasonable belief of their, you know, they are a bigger economic unit than the United States. They have a bigger population. They have better resources in the end than we do, and so on. And they don't have the political liabilities. They're not fighting wars everywhere, and so on. They are now in a state of shock, the way the American working class is too. Everything is falling apart, and that immobilizes them for a while. But they have the organizations, and they have the commitment, and ideologically, they're very clear. All the general strikes say what you said, Michael, namely, you are not going to fix this broken capitalist system on our backs, which is what they say. Here in the United States, where we've allowed our left organizations, trade unions, socialist, communist, and so on, parties, to atrophy over the last 50 years, way beyond anything the Europeans have seen, we, of course, lack the organizations that could, in another context, translate the suffering, the upset, the anger, the shock of our people into a powerful political force. But you need organization for that, and we don't have that. But I agree. I think that more and more of the leaders in the United States are becoming anxious that the level of inequality, the service of the government to just the big corporations and just the richest people, is going too far and is beginning to threaten social peace. When Warren Buffett makes a point of repeating that it's inappropriate in the United States that he have a lower tax rate than his secretary, you're beginning to see the signs that there's a recognition there's something wrong here. Whether that will be sufficient, I don't know. The greed of the mass of the corporations, they've had their way now for 30 years. Republicans and Democrats alike have basically gone in the direction they want. Their taxes have been cut. Their regulations have been relieved. Their celebration in the culture as heroes has been enhanced. Money is everything. Wealth is everything. Consumption is where you are. They've gotten most of what they want. I think they are going to become aware that to push further, which those below them who haven't shared in this, the smaller businesses, they still want to get theirs, but they're late to the party. And those who already got theirs do not want them to mess up the game. So I believe you will see big splits emerging in the right wing in America because these are different attitudes. And a coming together of those at the top because they're afraid of what's coming from below. Of course, if the American left remains quiet, if it doesn't make trouble, then it doesn't push this development, this split. The irony of the left is it could understand itself to be in a position where it has every reason to make the biggest noise imaginable in the streets of the United States, because that will weaken the other side. It will not bring them together. It will terrify them, as Wisconsin even for a little bit did. More of that will mean that the very top corporations who basically want peace here, they want peace in the United States not for the old reasons that you need a quiet society. It's actually different. Most large corporations in the United States have written off the United States. The United States is a dying, or to use the language of economics, a mature economy. Economic growth is happening elsewhere. The future growth of markets is in Asia, parts of Europe, Latin America. That's where they're organized. If you think of the longer run, starting in the 1960s, American corporations shifted production across, out of the country. Starting in the 1980s and 90s, they began to move white-collar work. We called it outsourcing, out of the United States. The new development, as those two continue, is to see the future growth of the market and demand for their products also outside. There's nothing left here. This is becoming the United States, the backwater that 50 years everything else in the world was. We are the backwater. The growth isn't here. And the money and the interest and the focus and the energy, they want a stable United States so that they can grow in the rest of the world, because that's where they think growth is coming. And that changes their attitude to the United States. They don't need to maintain the roads here the way they used to. They don't need to maintain the education in this country the way they... That's not... You cannot appeal to them by saying, this is good for you because you need these workers and you need these consumers. No, we don't. We don't need them as workers, and we don't expect them to be much in the way of consumers, because they would have to borrow, and we're not going to lend to them. And they would have to have higher wages, and we're not going to give that to them. We have no reason to. We have cheaper, better workers elsewhere. The situation has changed. And if I had to summarize it in any word, I would say, when real wages in America stopped rising in the 1970s, it was a trauma for the American working class. A trauma all the worse because it couldn't be spoken. It couldn't be discussed. Now we are coming to terms with the deferred trauma. 30 years of borrowing money to make believe it wasn't happening is over. You can't borrow anymore. You can't do more labor. We're already too many people working too many hours. It's done. And we're now having to face it. And in the tumult that unfolds in this society, the people with money and power want to make sure that they come out of this in good shape. And if that happens, then the rest of us are going to have to take it really in the ear. And that's what's being worked out. How badly the mass of a people are going to be cut is the only real debate that is going on in Washington. The Democrats and Obama, a little less. The Republicans, gung-ho. And the mass of people, including the business community, trying to figure which way to go in this situation. But neither of them proposing an alternative, not the left and not the right.
A few days ago, I saw an article in the Times on wealth and wealth in the United States. And what's interesting to me is my son always, when he came back from school, said, Michael, the issue isn't around what people make as income. The issue is in wealth, because white median wealth is something like $146,000. The black median wealth, according to the new article, is in the neighborhood of $5,000. Hispanic wealth is $6,000 or so. So we're talking about a differential of 20 to 1 for whites versus blacks, 18 to 1 for whites versus Latinos. And of course, blacks and Latinos make up probably close to a quarter of the country, or roughly that. We're talking about a country that's been traditionally unequal, but these figures now are the most unequal they've been since they have actually started recording them some 30 years ago. So I don't know how you look at that in the context of what you're saying.
Well, I think it's the fruit of everything I've been describing. I mean, that's really what we have seen. We've seen real wages flatten out since the 1970s. Productivity keeps going up. Productivity going up means what the worker produces for his or her employer keeps going up, and what the employer pays them is flat. Yeah, but you don't need an advanced degree to understand that in that situation, what a great old economist called the surplus, what's produced by workers that they give to their employer after the employer pays their wages, keeps rising because the wages are flat and the productivity rises. So what that means is the working class stays where it is, and the people who employ them keep raising more, and of course the inequality grows. The way to understand this historically is to say 40 years ago, if you made a list of the rich industrial advanced economies, the United States was less unequal than most of the others, France, England, Italy, and so forth. Now we are number one. We have leapt over all of that, as the numbers Michael mentions prove, and we are now the most unequal. And we have, you know, roughly 2-4% of our people own roughly half the wealth. And you don't really have to say much more than that. That's a wholly different economy. And if you have a prolonged recession, here's the way this comes down to it, then you're throwing people more and more, because they have low wages or no wages, on their wealth, their savings. What else are they going to turn to? So you're also seeing the effects even of the last 3 or 4 years, which are making it worse, because the mass of people is eating up the little bit of savings they have.
That's actually the critical point about wealth, because if a white person with $146,000 median loses a job, they're not going to lose their house right away. They're not going to lose their car right away. Right. If a African-American or a Hispanic with $5,000 or $6,000 in wealth, which is mainly in the car, gets thrown out of a job, where do they go? They lose their house, can't pay the rent, and they may even lose their car, and then they're done for. So wealth is like just an absolute key factor in that.
And if you add to that, that at the same time that they are suffering falling benefits, flat to lower real wages, large unemployment, eating up their savings, and the government is now planning to reduce the social supports the government provides, you are subjecting your working class to a major sustained attack on its standard of living. And to believe that this is all going to happen and they're all quietly going to sink into some resignation with no consequences is nutty. That's just nutty. There's no historical reason to believe that. Is it possible? Sure, it's almost anything is possible. But the much more likely scenario is a hyped-up search for scapegoats, some of which are going to scare all of us in this room and beyond, as well as a building up of a movement in this country to try to find some other solution. And as long as the people who are comfortable, who sit at the top of the economic pyramid, believe that this can continue, that they can continue to feather their own nest, protect their own well-being, and let the thing just play out, you're going to create a very, very dangerous situation. Because Americans are not only going to watch the gap between themselves and the richest of Americans, which they're used to, but they're going to encounter growing signs of working classes elsewhere in the world that are gaining on them. This notion that I'm a privileged, wonderful, lucky man or woman because I live in America and look what a wonder, that's not going to stay very long. You're going to see more and more television programs about workers in a lot of other places who are looking to be doing a lot better than you are and with better prospects to boot. One of the most sharp events in Greece in the last year has been the beginning of public awareness that young people in Greece are leaving Greece. There's no future. There's no jobs. If they have an education, they're going elsewhere. If they're looking for an education, they think they better get it outside of Greece, because inside of Greece, there's not going to be anything, so they better get out as soon as possible, make connections in another country. The Greeks are losing the best of their people on a scale that reminds one of the 19th century, when you had exoduses of masses of Europeans, because that is one of the ways, as well as street demonstrations, that this problem is going to be worked out. To imagine it's all going to solve itself in a smooth way is nuts. One last point, just to drive it home. When the crisis hit here in 2007 and 2008, if you recall, the first failures to pay your debts were dubbed subprime mortgage owners. And the right wing immediately leapt to its normal social task of blaming these poor people who had taken out bad loans and couldn't afford them for being irresponsible for having done this. You blame the victim, all the rest. We now know from every day of the week how the banks manipulated and lied to these people. I mean, and they're admitting it. Wells Fargo last week did it. Countrywide under Bank of America did it. Admitted, I mean, to their frauds. Yeah. But put it all aside, there was this notion, President Bush said it, we can contain this. We can contain it. It'll be the subprime, and that's bad, but that's a relative. That's Greece. We can contain this. We can contain it. We're going to bail them out. It's not going to spread to. This is silly. And the same blaming. The Greeks are profligate. They don't work very hard. They demand too much. The Greeks are irresponsible. It's the same game. The attempt to isolate, to freeze, to inoculate the rest of the population so they don't fear what's coming. It's falling apart in Europe, but it will fall apart here too. Nobody even remembers the subprime. It's now clear that the bulk of loans that are not working are not subprime, they were prime. It makes no difference because it's a social problem. It's not a problem. It's just that the poor people suffer first and collapse first, because that's what it means to be poor. But the contagion is spreading, and the cost is spreading. In Europe, for example, the great struggle is between those who want to see this as a struggle between capital and labor in a system that doesn't work. The right-wing answer is, no, no, no. This is a struggle between us workers here in Germany and those irresponsible ones in Greece. They try to make it from an economic problem to a national problem, an ethnic problem. And so that's the struggle there. The right-wing, anti-immigrant, it's all about those terrible people in the South, which we shouldn't allow to come here, and we shouldn't bail them out. So save Germany. The left has to say, no, no, no. This is a problem that's already here that we were complicit in the first place. And if we don't deal with it in our country, they will do to us next what they're doing to the Greeks now. That's a classic kind of left-right split. It's understood in Europe, but it isn't understood here.
This has been a remarkable interview, as usual, with you. And it just explains things so well. And here we're all focused on, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and the debt, and you really bring it home. But my last question to you, to go back to the original theme, were you a investment advisor and I came to you with money, would you tell me I should buy U.S. Treasury bonds?
U.S. Treasury bonds are probably more of a peculiar asset. Is it a risk you'll lose? No. But in a way that hasn't been true in my lifetime, the status of the U.S. Treasury bond from the absolute bedrock blip isn't anymore.
It's the most was the most secure investment
absolutely,
you can make in the world.
Absolutely. AAA, there aren't that many AAAs. The other AAA-rated governments are like Switzerland. They're little. They don't have very much debt, so you can't invest that much. The United States still is the standard bearer, the great place where you can not only put your money, but it's highly liquid. You can convert that Treasury security into cash in a matter of seconds from any computer terminal in the world. So, and for many people, that's as important a security as is the asset itself. All of that is diminished. No one knows what the long-term consequences will be, how that will interact with other phenomena. But this is not good. This is a sign of an economic crisis that is not only not helping the mass of people who still labor with unemployment and foreclosure, but it is a political system and a total system that isn't functioning the way everyone assumed and wants. So I would say be very, at this point, enormous caution if you're an investor, because none of the assumed verities is reliable. It just isn't anymore. We don't know what the Europeans are going to do when their bailout of Greece fails again, because already failed twice.
Well, thank you very much, Rick Wolf. As usual, a stunning interview. We're all taking off to the woods and going to grow our own crops and
take our money out of the bank,
collect rainwater, and head off.
You guys recommended it to me.
Rick Wolf, really, again, from Law and Disorder, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
Well, thank you guys and ladies and gentlemen, because you make a program that informs the American people in ways too few programs do. And so it's a pleasure for me to be a part of that process.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.